Hello, it's Debbie back again on January 27th, Wednesday, 2016, starting part two of the Decatur Herald in Review, as usual, with the death notices. Decatur, Barkalow, John Culver Barkalow III, 71, passed away on January 23rd, 2016, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Memorials may be made to the American Cancer Society Hope Lodge on Lyndall Boulevard, 4215 Lyndall Boulevard, St. Louis, 63108, to Mount Zion Presbyterian Church, or to Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation in Connecticut. Services will be at Funk's Grove Church, Funk's Grove, Illinois, on Friday, January 29th at 11 a.m. with Pastor Mike Wakeland officiating. Burial will be immediately following the service at the church cemetery. There will be no visitation. Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home in Mount Zion is assisting the family with services. Warrensburg, Janes. Donna Janes, 94, of Warrensburg, Illinois, passed away Monday, January 25th, 2016, at McKinley Court with her family by her side. A graveside service to celebrate Donna's life will be 11 a.m. Friday, January 29th, in Graceland Cemetery. The family of Donna Janes is being served by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home on North Oakland Avenue, Decatur. Mount Zion, Duggar. Rosalie Mardell Duggar, 77, in Mount Zion, Illinois, passed away at 11:55 a.m. Saturday, January 23, 2016, in St. Mary's Hospital with her family by her side. A service to celebrate Rosalie's life will be held 7 p.m. Thursday, January 28, at Lampstand Presbyterian Church with Pastor Jack Beiser officiating. The family will receive friends beginning at 5 p.m. Thursday evening at the church. Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, Mount Zion, will be assisting the family with services. In lieu of flowers, the family suggests memorials be made to a cancer fund of your choice. Decatur, Gomez. Luis Arthur Gomez, Art, 85, born July 17, 1930, in Los Angeles, passed away peacefully into his eternal heavenly home on January 22, 2016, in Jupiter, Florida. A funeral service will be held on Friday, January 29th, at Life Foursquare Church, Decatur, Illinois, at 1 p.m., with visitation convening at 11 a.m. until service time. Burial will be in Mount Zion Township Cemetery, Mount Zion, Illinois. Britlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur, will be assisting the family with arrangements. Decatur, Harris. Madison Janice Harris, infant daughter of Brooke R. Harris and Torione M. Hart Horace, was placed in the loving arms of Jesus on Wednesday, January 20th, 2016, in Decatur. Private family services will be in Lullaby Land in Fairlawn Cemetery. The family of Madison Janice Harris has entrusted the care of their loved one to Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home on Oakland Avenue in Decatur. Decatur, Wachholz. Myra Lee Wachholz, 64, Decatur, passed away Sunday, January 24th, at St. Mary's Hospital, Decatur. Funeral services will be 11:30 a.m. Friday, January 29th, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, with visitation from 10:30 a.m. until service time. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery, Decatur. Britlinger and Earl Funeral Homes, Decatur, are assisting the family with the arrangements. Memorials may be made to the St. Paul's Lutheran Church or to Corman House, Myra's group home. Decatur, Harris. Sorry, we've said that one. Decatur, Densler. Walt A. Densler, 75, of Decatur, Illinois, passed away unexpectedly at home on Saturday, January 23, 2016, in Decatur. Visitation will be held from 4 to 6 Friday, January 29th, at Britlinger and Earl Funeral Home, followed by a memorial service. His body was donated for scientific study. In lieu of flowers, contribution may be made to the American Heart Association or the Ronald McDonald House Charities of Central Illinois. Decatur, English. Betty June English, 81, of Decatur, went to be with her Lord on Monday, January 25th, 2016, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Funeral service to celebrate June's life will be 11 a.m. Saturday, January 30th, 2016, in Moran and Goble Funeral Home on North Monroe Avenue in Decatur. Visitation will be from 9 to 11 Saturday in the funeral home. Burial will be at Macon County Memorial Park, Decatur. Memorials are suggested to the Alzheimer's Association. Decatur, Dobler. K. Ellen Dobler, 66, of Decatur, passed away Sunday, January 24th at St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur. Services to celebrate Kay's life will be 10 a.m. Saturday, January 30th at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 Friday, January 29th at the funeral home. Entombment will be at the Mary Queen of Angels Garden Mausoleum at Graceland Cemetery. Memorials in Kay's honor are suggested to Cancer Care Specialists of Central Illinois or Homeward Bound Pet Shelter. Decatur, Sullivan. Dylan Sullivan, 21, of Decatur, passed away Saturday, January 23, 2016, in Decatur Memorial Hospital. Services to celebrate Dylan's life will be 11 a.m. Thursday, January 28th at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home on North Oakland in Decatur. Visitation will be at 10 a.m. Visitation will be at 10 a.m. January 28th tomorrow at Graceland's Fairlawn. Burial will be in Graceland Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, the family requests any love offering be sent to Martin Sullivan to help cover funeral costs. Family requests casual attire. The family of Dylan Sullivan is being served by Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Greenup, Buchanan, Steve Roy Buchanan, 67, of Greenup, Illinois, passed away peacefully at 2:45 a.m. on Saturday, January 23rd at Carl Foundation Hospital. Funeral services will be held at 11:30 a.m. on Thursday, January 28th at the Barclay Funeral Chapel in Greenup, Illinois, with Father Jeff Grant presiding. Graveside services will follow in the Greenup Cemetery. Visitation will be held Wednesday evening, tonight, at the Barclay Funeral Chapel from 6 to 8. Having been a survivor of cancer, Steve had such a compassion for children suffering from disease and was a loyal supporter of St. Jude's Hospital for Children. He also supported the Cumberland Schools, where he and his children attended, played sports, and his daughter, Missy, taught. Therefore, memorials in Steve's honor may be made to the St. Jude's or the Cumberland Middle School donation account in care of Stacy Kaiser, middle school principal. Sullivan, Cochran. G. Leon Cochran, 81, a resident at Trent Woods, North Carolina, died unexpectedly on January 22, 2016, at home after battling a number of health issues. Visitation will be on January 30, 2016, in the McMullen Young Funeral Home in Sullivan at 1 p.m., followed by a brief memorial service. Burial follow at the Green Hill Cemetery. Contributions on Leon's behalf can be made to the after-school program through the online giving portal at the Centenary Church and will be greatly appreciated. Chestnut, Haley. After 4.5 years of courageously battling breast cancer, Tricia Michelle Haley, 47, was called home to join her Lord and Savior at 5:45 p.m. January 23rd at her residence, Chestnut, Illinois, while surrounded by family and friends. Friends and family are invited to join in a ceremony celebrating her life at 10 a.m. Friday, January 29th, at the Assembly of God Church, Clinton, Illinois, with Pastor David Catron and Pastor Dan Bell officiating. Burial will follow at Laena Cemetery, Chestnut, Illinois. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 p.m. Thursday, January 28th at the church. Calvert Funeral Home, Clinton, is in charge of arrangements. Memorials may be made to the Allison and Madison Haley's Education Fund. And that is the end of the obituaries for Wednesday, January 27th, 2016, as listed in the Decatur Herald and Review. Going on to another article on this page, good deed leads to big loss. Cremains taken as man aids accident victims in Hawaii. This is by Bill Boley, Lee News Services writer. When Stefan Lewis hurried to help at a car crash earlier this month in Waimea, Hawaii, he set his backpack down, and while he was doing all he could to free one of the victims of the accident, someone stole it. Really? Somebody stole my bag while I was trying to help someone? Everyone knew it was my bag, Lewis said. How do you steal from a man who's up there trying to help someone hurt in a crash? Well, it was disappointing to lose a wetsuit or a collector book in the backpack. That wasn't what most upset Lewis. He was also carrying the ashes of his father and his grandmother. It's not just a wetsuit and a book, he said. My family's in there. The backpack he can live without, but he would like the plastic baggies with ashes labeled Dad and Grandmother back. I've been taking them everywhere with me. Lewis, originally from Houston, said he traveled to the world, visiting South America, Central America, Mexico, Europe, and nearly every state in the U.S. On his journeys, he's sprinkled ashes of his father, Owen Lewis, who died in 2004, at places he felt were special, and hoped to do the same with them on Kauai. The surfer and former BMX racer had been on Kauai about 4 months. Saturday, he biked from Anhola to Waimea, and after spending some of the day, he was ready to catch a bus back to the North Shore when the accident occurred. A van traveling east lost control, jumped the westbound lanes, jumped the curb, and hit two parked pickups across from Big Safe. Lewis, who has EMT training, ran to the scene, dropped his pack. The man in the van was bleeding and showed signs of trauma, Lewis said. The van was smoking and fluids were leaking out. This could be a bad situation, he said he thought at the time. A crowd quickly formed and many were recording the scene with their smartphones. Lewis wedged the van door open and held it. Firefighters and EMTs arrived So Lewis, after seeing if there was anything more he could do, returned to retrieve his backpack. It was gone. After asking around and walking around town, he gave up his search. Whoever took the backpack must have been surprised when they looked inside. I can only imagine what somebody thought when they found somebody's ashes in a backpack, the 30-year-old said. What would you do if you saw a bag that said Dad and one that said Grandmother? He said he was 18 years old when his father died, and he had difficulty coping with his death. Spreading ashes in his travels has helped. His mother recently sent him some of his grandmother's ashes because Kauai seemed a great place to sprinkle them along with his father's. I was planning to do it when the time and place was right. Lewis was angry about the theft at first. Then he decided to find the positive in it. His father, he said, and his grandmother, Billy Weber, always taught him to make a positive impact on others. He said he enjoys meeting and speaking with people and helping them make through the day by spreading smiles. His mantra is healthy living, caring, and compassion every day, no matter what. You can't take my happiness or my smile, said Lewis. It's not about what's in your pocket. It's about what's in your heart that matters. End of the article. The next thing is a To Your Good Health column written by Dr. Keith Roach. And there's three questions that he has answered here. Dear Dr. Roach, years ago I was told that eating raw carrots and fresh spinach improves vision. Is there truth to this? And if so, why am I afflicted with macular degeneration after having eaten these for such a long time? I also have taken vitamins to preserve vision for 10 years. Do these have justification? Anonymous. His answer. Fresh vegetables with beta-carotene and certain multivitamins and minerals have been shown to slow the effect of age-related macular degeneration. It may have been you would have gotten macular degeneration both sooner and more severely than you have it. Now that you've not had a... And just a minute, I will come back here. Repeat here. It may be that you would have gotten macular degeneration both sooner and more severely than you have it now had you not had a healthy diet and you had not had a health and taken the vitamins. Unfortunately, we don't know of any preventive treatment nor any treatment once the disease has been diagnosed that is 100% effective. The book on macular degeneration explains more about this, which you could order from him. The next question is on a tilt table test. Dear Dr. Roach, what is a tilt table test for? Signed, J.C. Answer. The tilt table test is most commonly ordered to determine the cause of syncope, a sudden loss of consciousness. Most cases of syncope are caused by a simple faint called vasovagal syncope and can be reliably diagnosed as such by an experienced clinician after a careful history and physical exam. In people with a history of syncope and with risk factors for coronary artery disease, blockages in the blood vessel of the heart that can lead to heart attack, it is important to evaluate for heart blockages with a stress test or an angiogram. If coronary disease has been ruled out and if the syncope is recurrent, then a tilt table test may be ordered. It's sometimes used to distinguish between convulsive syncope, fainting associated with muscular spasm, and epilepsy. As its name implies, the tilt table is capable of moving a patient rapidly between lying down and upright while monitoring symptoms, the EKG and blood pressure. Sometimes medication is used to improve the sensitivity of the test. However, the test is neither 100% sensitive nor specific. As a general internist, I seldom order this test and refer unexpected cases of recurrent syncope to a cardiologist. And the last question, what is BHT? Dear Dr. Roach, I'm curious about the preservative BHT. I don't believe I've ever seen this addressed in your column. I try to eat as natural as possible, but I do have cold cereal sometimes in the morning. Almost all boxes have the preservative BHT. Should I be concerned? Answer. Oh, that was JW. Answer. Butylated hydroxyline tolefrine, BHT, is a commonly used antioxidant preservative used in foods and cosmetics. The safety has been extensively studied, but there remain conflicting reports, as some studies show an increase in others, a reduction in cancer risk in animals. It's also sold as a nutritional supplement. Jeepers. At the extremely low doses used as a food preservative, the consensus of most scientists, including the Food Drug Administration, is that it has very low risk. This end of that article by Dr. Keith Roach, who writes for the North America Syndicate, and you can write to him at 628 Virginia Drive, Orlando, Florida, 32803, or email to your good health at med.cornell.edu. And the last article on this page, D4, police training focuses on dealing with disabilities. And there's a picture here of a hug and an officer, and it says, Howard County Police Department entry-level recruit Michael Scanlon left talks with Jane Papinger and her autistic 13-year-old son, David. The recruits attended a pool party with the Howard County Autism Society to get firsthand experience interacting with autistic children, adults, and their families. This is from the Tribune News Service, a writer for them, Tim Prudente. Baltimore. Say a young man is pacing outside a house. A police officer asks him to stop, but the young man keeps pacing. Maybe the young man notices the officer's gun and just wants to touch it. He reaches. They may not know not to come up and touch their guns, Elizabeth Benavides said. Her teenage son is autistic and often repeats words said to him. If you're an officer, she said, you might think that's really flippant. Benavides plans this week to help train police recruits to resolve such encounters with de-escalation tactics. Speak calmly, give space, be patient. The 11 recruits will be the first police class in Howard County to take the four-hour training on intellectual and developmental disabilities after it becomes a requirement for recruits across Maryland. Some of the 11 recruits had their first encounters with autism Sunday evening during a pool party with the Howard County Autism Society. The recruits served pizza poolside at the Lifetime Athletic in Columbia. About 40 families arrived. I just fear people won't understand my son, said Sabina Sambat, mother of 12-year-old Nico. The mandatory police training comes 3 years after a 26-year-old man with Down syndrome died in a struggle with Frederick County Sheriff's Department. Robert Ethan Saylor died after deputies tried to remove him from a Frederick, Maryland movie theater. Sailor attended a screening of Zero Dark 30 with an aide and refused to leave when it ended. Three off-duty sheriff's police working as security officers handcuffed Sailor. According to the sheriff's office, Sailor suffered a medical emergency. The deputies removed the handcuffs, attempted CPR, and called for emergency workers, the sheriff's office said. Sailor died soon after that. A medical examiner ruled his death a homicide and found that Sailor died of positional asphyxia and excited delirium complicated by his disability and weight. A grand jury declined to indict the sheriff's deputies, and an internal investigation cleared them of wrongdoing. 8 months after Sailor's death, then-Governor Martin O'Malley met with his family and pledged to improve police training. He formed a commission that recommended all new recruits be trained on intellectual and developmental disabilities. The Maryland Police Training Commission adopted the recommendation last year. Also last year, the General Assembly passed legislation to fund an alliance within the State Department of Disabilities to recruit and train disabled people. They will then help train police. Patty Sailor said Sunday she is, quote, still a sad and grieving mother. That's never going to change. But I think this is a victory for individuals with developmental and intellectual disabilities, she said. There is a movement to recognize their value, that they can contribute. In Howard County, Lieutenant Bill Chavron will lead the training with Benavides, a former president of the Howard County Autism Society. Howard County has 764 students with autism, according to the most recent state data available. That's about 16% of all students, well above the state average of 9.8%. And that's the end of that article. Couple of fun articles on the beginning of a D section. No kids' birthday forgotten. Box of Balloons group wants all children to have a unique and special day. This is by Jane Burns, Lee News Service writer, and then the next article is a Decatur-based one. Madison, Wisconsin. For many kids, a birthday filled with Hello Kitty or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles might not be so unique. And if that's the case, a local organization calls its mission a success. Sun Prairie, Wisconsin-based Box of Balloons just celebrated its second birthday, but it's the birthday of kids from economically challenged families that are the sole purpose of the organization. What is seen as a tradition and a rite of passage in most families can become lost in the shuffle for financial or practical reasons for other families. Everybody thinks of children at Christmas time, but not so much on their birthday, said Michelle Krogstad, a Box of Balloons volunteer who heads up a Madison chapter of the organization. Everyone has a birthday. Everyone should be celebrated. Box of Balloons was founded in Sun Prairie in November 2013 by Nicole Mall. With a simple concept of gathering personalized items needed to throw a child a birthday party, right down to the cupcakes in a gift box and a gift. Box of Balloons has helped more than 350 families in homeless or domestic abuse shelters and other difficult situations to do just that. Most of the families don't even have a house, so no way could these parents even think about a birthday party for their child, Mall said. The organization grew from a core group of volunteers that Mall called together to discuss ideas and quickly found favor. In just 2 years, it has grown to have 11 chapters in 5 states, including one in Bloomington, Illinois. They all said, "Our kids get a birthday party. We can't even think about not being able to do that for our child," Mall said at the first meeting with volunteers. It was sad to think that so many kids' parents can't even begin to think about that. Each box that is delivered is made up of 7 items donated by volunteers to cover a party for at least 6 people. Tableware, decorations, do-it-yourself decorations to customize for the child, a party game or activity, a party favor, cupcakes, and a gift. Cupcakes can be baked or purchased, and all those going to school must be purchased. The total cost of supplies is in the $50 to $75 range, depending on what a volunteer wants to spend on a gift, and everything must fit in a 12 by 12 by 18-inch box. It's been a learning curve for the volunteers to have to think about what the child's going to love. That is also practical, Molly said. They may not. Ooh. Got to skip to page D2. Have a DVD player. They might not have a bedroom. These are all things to take into consideration. Mall got the idea for Box of Balloons from a friend who had told her about an organization in New York called Birthday Fairies, which throws parties for children in need. Mall, who has a background in social work, liked the idea, but thought empowering parents and caregivers should be an element, too. I thought, how awkward to set up this huge party for people we don't know, said Mall, who has three children. And what are the parents doing, standing on the sidelines feeling bad because they couldn't do it for their own child? As far as most children know, volunteers had nothing to do with the box of balloon supplies, and the party was from their parents. Box of Balloons doesn't take requests from families, but works through social service organizations and school social workers. In the Madison area, Box of Balloons works with The Road Home, an organization that helps homeless families. Domestic Abuse Intervention Services, the YWCA, and is beginning to work with Head Start programs, among other groups. Case managers or social workers pass on requests that include the child's age, gender, favorite color, interests, and a gift request. Chapter leaders deliver the boxes to caseworkers and school social workers who pass them on to parents or caregivers. There are always theme requests, said Mall, who is also a part-time recreation supervisor in DeForest. The kids know what they want. Parties go with themes of Monster High, Frozen, Paw Patrol, basketball, football, Legos, jewelry making, or crafts. Most of the volunteers sign up to buy a certain item, something as simple as plates, silverware, and napkins. Then they drop it off at a certain spot, usually the home of a chapter leader. Families have donated boxes together, as have offices. The unique and sometimes challenging thing about the volunteer work, Mall said, is volunteers don't meet the people they're helping and don't get to see the party they're planning. All the connections with the families are made through social workers or caseworkers. Volunteers just know the party's happening and occasionally see a photo. It really is no strings attached, Mall said. You give and you just imagine what they're going to do with it. End of that article. And our final article today for part two is by Danette Beckett for the Herald and Review. Jazz Fest remains as strong as ever. 41st annual event set for February 5th through the 7th in Decatur. After 41 years, one would think the Central Illinois Jazz Festival would begin to slow down, but Decatur would not let that happen. It's high energy, said Juve Jazz Society's co-president, Carol Jauntry. High energy. The festival will be presented again from February 5th through 7th at the Decatur Conference Center and Hotel. Fans flock to Decatur from all over the country to see many big names, acts in jazz. We compete with other large festivals. San Diego, Clearwater, said Michael Jauntry, co-president of the Juve Jazz Society. The musicians have also traveled to the festival from as far away as Oregon and New York. The three-day festival, with four separate sessions, allow fans the opportunity to listen to more than a dozen musical groups, many during the same hour. Special guests also join in the festivities. The main complaint, I couldn't see all of it, Michael Jauntry said of the festival feedback. Even if you get a ticket for all four sessions, you might miss someone. To produce such an event takes a great deal of energy. Other jazz festivals, such as those in Chicago, began to see a decline in the attendance during the past few years. It's harder to get hotels in the big city. They don't want to work with you, said Maggie Parker Brown, director for the Central Illinois Jazz Festival. And this is a lot of work. If you go, the Central Illinois Jazz Festival, 5th, 6th, and 7th at the Conference Center, cost $145 for all sessions, $35 for a single session. Each year, the Juve Jazz Society dedicates the weekend in honor of a person and their contributions made to the Central Illinois Jazz Festival. Founding Juve member Bob Paulstrom will be given this year's dedication, along with his encouragement of young musicians. The late newspaper man's contributions through his stories and support have benefited the festival through the year. The festival has always promised a lively atmosphere, which is what drew Falstrom to the music. The musicians find the same enjoyment playing with various bands. They'll feed off of one another, Michael said. That's when the music really gets good. End of that article. End of part two, Decatur Herald and Review, as read by Debbie on Wednesday, January 27th, 2016. Talk to you again next week.